The state is going to court on October 6th to try and force Airbnb to turn over records of Hawaii vacation rentals in an effort to see if operators have been paying their fair share of transient vacation tax. The city administration and the Honolulu City Council have been wrestling with how to deal with the thousands of illegal units that have sprung up over the decades because of a lack of enforcement. The Honolulu Planning Commission has been reviewing several proposals for regulating short-term rentals. Over 100 people turned out for public hearings earlier this month. The commission met again yesterday afternoon and rejected legislation proposed by Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell. HPR's Ryan Finnerty was there.
The Honolulu Planning Commission unanimously voted down a sweeping proposal on short-term rentals that covered everything from property taxes to parking. The wide-ranging bill would significantly change the way owners can rent out their property to vacationers and had generated opposition from residents on all sides of the issue. Under the proposal, an unlimited number of bed and breakfasts, or B&Bs, would be officially authorized in residential areas. A B&B is also called home sharing, where the owner rents out rooms in the home where they live. The Hawaii Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice supports the effort to regulate short-term rentals, but opposes this measure. Will Carone is Appleseed's spokesperson.
This bill, as currently written, in our opinion, based on our analysis, would actually potentially make things worse for residents than they already are. And that has a lot to do with a number of, I guess you could call them loopholes in the bill. And it comes down to a lack of enforcement, as well as some incredibly broad definitions that we feel could be easily taken advantage of. The bill allows for unlimited B&Bs in residential zoned areas, so that's a big difference right there. And because of the vagueness of those definitions, what ends up happening could be something that is not a traditional B&B. It could be something much more along the lines of what we're calling a TVU, a temporary vacation unit. So if we're going to try to allow B&Bs, but try to restrict transient vacation units, TVUs, the definitions need to be tightened up quite a bit in order to achieve that goal. Essentially, because of the lack of enforcement, it just opens up a lot of opportunity for people to sort of skirt around the law, and because there's no enforcement, there's no real reason for them to follow the law. The main point of our testimony comes down to a lack of enforcement overall, not just with the B&Bs, although that is a problem. The unlimited number is definitely a problem. We think that the number needs to be limited, and it needs to take into account the different developmental plans or sustainable community plans with different areas of the island. So we have to be able to hold the platforms that are advertising these units accountable if we want to have any hope of regulating this industry.
Under the mayor's proposal, those TVUs would be limited to resort areas like Waikiki and Ko'olina. Roughly 4,000 TVU permits would be issued for the entire island of Oahu. There are some supporters of the proposed law. The Oahu Alternative Lodging Association represents the short-term rental industry on the island. Bryn Revito is the group's vice president.
After 30 years of not having, you know, any sort of permitting process in place and, you know, lack of enforcement, we were really encouraged, you know, by the fact that there was even a bill that was being passed around, and it was a good start. It wasn't perfect, but without any system in place at all, I think everyone is just operating, you know, with a lot of uncertainty. And I think at least the good hosts, you know, that we want transparency. You know, they want to pay, not only pay their taxes, pay for a permit, you know, pay for whatever fees, you know, come along with being allowed to run their business. You know, I think that right now everyone sort of feels like they're doing something wrong. We really felt like here's our chance. You know, this is like the right vehicle. The DPP really did a good job, I think, with getting a lot of provisions out there. You know, I mean, it wasn't this oversimplified bill. I mean, they really thoughtfully went through a lot of the different sort of aspects of the industry, you know. Not everyone's going to get what they want. The fact that the bill didn't allow for TVUs in the residential areas was a really big issue for us because, you know, there's so many houses, especially in like Portlock, Diamond Head, Kahala. A lot of these houses are pretty expensive now, you know. I mean, even in like Portlock, for example, like the homes in that area are like, you know, $2 million. If those homes have been empty for many years. So if the bill allowed for some of these homes to be vacation rentals, like that would generate a lot of economic activity in the area and also just put some kind of use to the homes that have been empty for a really long time. But I think that is at least having some system in place gives, you know, the short-term rental hosts and a lot of the members of our organization, you know, a chance to sort of plan their businesses. You know, I mean, a lot of these people do this full time. They'll be out of a job if the industry is shut down.
Although none of the proposals were approved by the Planning Commission, the Honolulu City Council can still pass any of the five bills under consideration. They will now need at least 6 votes to pass, rather than the usual simple majority of 5. I'm Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
That was HBR's Ryan Finnerty tracking the contentious proposals to increase bed and breakfast units and to crack down on whole home rentals. Some of the concerns raised by planning commissioners were the unlimited number of bed and breakfasts, which areas rentals would be allowed in, and the potential loss of businesses for owners currently operating legal rentals. Stay with Hawaii Public Radio for the latest updates on this issue. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Board shorts, as far back as anyone can remember, have been a staple in the surfing community. And until 2005, there was only one place to get the board shorts. The Miura store in Haleiwa opened its doors in 1912 as a tailor shop, specializing in custom suits, elegant gowns, and clothes for plantation workers. A Miura store tasted its initial fame when Grandma Miura sewed up a holoku gown for Queen Liliuokalani. The shop shifted gears slightly when Grandpa Miura got his start by making canvas work clothes at home for fellow plantation laborers. Perhaps the most well-known item originating from that family store was the custom-made palaka surfing shorts. Now, palaka was originally a white and blue plaid denim made into clothing for plantation workers, as it was a thick material not easily worn out. For today's quiz, can you tell us the name of the two sister seamstresses to popularize the palaka shorts in the surfing community? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people that you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Alex Monty Fox from Mid-Pacific School of the Arts. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
With our humpback whales? That's the question that started to be asked as reports began trickling in across the Pacific that maybe the numbers were smaller than in previous whale-watching seasons. We talked to Ed Lyman with NOAA's National Marine Whale Sanctuary on Maui about what he was hearing and seeing out in the field.
It started back in the 2015-2016 season, wintering season, breeding calving season, and the way it started, a lot of these reports do start is from the tour companies or the people on the water, you know, the tour operators, the fishermen, the whale researchers that are out there. And at first they were just saying, boy, the whales seem to be coming late. You know, we don't see as many as we've been seeing in previous seasons at this time of year. And this is like late December, early January. And so we took notice of that, you know, they've been helping us out, part of that monitoring program that the sanctuary takes a lead with. And we called around to some of the other islands, same thing. The reports were all the same. And so we started monitoring it, and it ended up that, yeah, the numbers did increase through the season as we got into that peak, January, February, March. but they never got as high as they had been getting. There's still plenty of whales around, but not as many as we've been getting in those previous seasons. And then that carried over for the next year. So basically, it wasn't just a little spike. It was something else going on here that really basically everyone took notice. Many researchers, beyond even Dr. Lammers and Dr. Cartwright and Chris Gabriel, myself, many more involved.
So is it just that initially they were just late, like on Hawaiian time?
That was the perception. Yep, exactly. That that time of year, and again, this started with the tour companies off the Big Island. Those were they were the first ones to draw our attention to this. And at first we thought, well, this is just patchiness in the distribution of humpback whales around the islands, which is very typical. There's been many a times where one island might call in, let us know, and say, hey, we don't see too many humpback whales around here. But another island at the other end of the chain might say, plenty of whales over here. So we had to be careful of that. And that's what makes this difficult, in that humpback whales don't necessarily, you know, they have their favorite times and places, but they're also moving around there and moving dependent on each other. That's why they're here, breeding, calving time.
Well, you were hearing stuff from Mexico. You were hearing stuff from Mexico.
That too, exactly. So at first, I mean, again, we get these reports. We're starting to pay attention. And I actually did not call Mexico. So I work with really the entanglement responders in Mexico. Again, my role is coordinating that response to entangle whales, one of the threats. And so they called me up, and they said, boy, what do you have for humpback whales? Because we have very few. And later, as we followed up on this, I remember certain parts of Mexico, the tourist industry was shutting down early because they weren't having enough whales. That was not happening here. We still had plenty of whales for the tourist industry. But from parts of Mexico, that was not the case. And then secondhand, I got information from the western North Pacific, Philippines, same thing there. So it was something much broader, and it was real. It wasn't just that patchiness that I mentioned earlier. Something was going on.
Well, I'm trying to think now, because in 2016, didn't we have that bleaching effect? So what would temperature have to do with it?
Yep. Well, and that's one of the theories here, is that we've had environmental changes, one of those being temperatures in our oceans, and we had, you know, an El Nino close that time. You had the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, that long-term cycle of warming of the North Pacific and cooling of the Pacific there. It was somewhat aligned in a warmer cycle. We had the blob up off of Alaska, British Columbia, and Washington, Oregon there, that warm cell of water. So there were several different environmental factors aligned, if you will, that represented warmer temperatures that could affect the food resource, which then affects the humpback whales, as just one example of what might be going on.
Okay, so then what do we do?
Well, right now it's about trying to figure out what is happening. And if it is an environmental cycle, then, for instance, it may shift. Right now, where that Pacific Decadal Cycle is, we're just over the hump on that. El Nino is diminished. The blob, they think, is diminishing. So we may see a bounce back in that food, well, the temperatures cooling down, the food resource increasing, and there's some hint maybe that is happening, because up in Alaska you've got, you know, researchers up there. I know Chris Gabriel studies humpback whales here in Hawaii as well as Alaska, and I was lending a hand this year. And what we were noticing is that some of the humpback whales we've been seeing the last couple of years were thin. They were emaciated. Okay, We saw fewer of those emaciated whales this summer up in the feeding grounds of Alaska. So maybe that's a hint that the food resource is starting to bounce back and the whales are feeding more. And if they're feeding more, females are in a better position to bear calves. They'll come down to Hawaii, or the males have more fuel in the fuel tank, so to speak. It's a long run. It's a 2,500 nautical mile one way migration to get here. So you need to be healthy to do so. So those are all maybe just an indication that things might be turning around.
Well, I know the folks over at Coconut Island have been tagging sharks. What do we have in place for tagging whales?
Well, we do some tagging whales, along with our state and federal partners. Those tend to be suction cup tags, and those are shorter term, and they have acoustic packages. But there are scientists like Dr. Bruce Mate out of Oregon State would be a prime example. The sanctuary has helped him the last couple of years put some longer-term tags on the whales such that you can track their migrations, their movement patterns around the islands, as well as back and forth between the Hawaiian Islands, in this case, the stock of humpback whales, and primarily Alaska feeding grounds. So there is examples of that that might, again, that might be some information there that will help us figure out what is going on. Because that's the first step, is figure out what is going on.
Is it more tricky to tag a whale than it is a shark?
The whale does, you know, it's some air-breathing mammal's going to come right to the surface at some point. And if you are patient and take your time there, you can come up and get the tag on at that surface interval. The shark doesn't necessarily have to come up, right? So you've got to wait for that opportunity. Or you can catch it and reel it in and be careful and put the tag on. So it's just different. Humpback whales are not deep divers. Mm-hmm. That's your sperm whales, and there's other species we can keep going on. But humpback whales generally 1,000 feet or less on the dive depths.
But maybe that would be a way to be able to glean more information as to what's going on.
Yep, and definitely we are looking into that. And that's what we have to do. And I know that Dr. Mark Lammers here at the sanctuary, he's our research coordinator, has been trying to lead an effort, coordinate, getting us all together, getting the different researchers, resource managers together. We're going to do this in November and have a meeting that we can look at, you know, what do we already know, what do we not know, where are our gaps in information, how might we fill those gaps and corroborate, work together to gain some more information and to determine what might be going on here. And is it long term? Is it something like an environmental factor that's just going to be short term, like a couple of years, and bounce back? And there's another whole aspect here. And are the humpback whales reaching their carrying capacity? I mean, we know there's a lot of humpback whales now. They're on that recovery. We've taken them off the endangered species list. Are they getting to a point where maybe they're reaching their capacity and the resource that they have? They're going to start slowing down the production. They may not be have enough food to always come down to Hawaii and breed and give birth. And that's what we might be seeing along with. See, nothing's ever simple. Maybe along with some environmental factors on top of that. So, and that's just some of the questions that we need to answer.
Do we know roughly, like, the numbers?
You know, this is already over 10 years old, I know, but there was a great research project done throughout the North Pacific, over 400 researchers, 10 different countries, and again, that example of working together. And they got a population estimate for the stock of humpback whales that come or use Hawaii as that breeding cattle ground of just over 10,000 animals. Now, that is over 10 years old. The population increase at the time was estimated around 4.5% up to 6%, but we can't make the assumption that growth rate has maintained itself.
That was NOAA's Ed Lyman talking about the work underway to determine if our whale population is dropping and what might be behind the fewer sightings this season.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the 2018 Chef Fest at Four Seasons Resort Hualalai, featuring tastings, classes, dinners, and talk story with national chefs. On now, fourseasons.com/Hualalai.
Now time for the reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Blaise Lovell's on the line with us this morning with a story about a Mililani neighborhood that is grappling with a very big bill because of a landslide threat. Good morning.
Morning, Catherine. And yes, it's a very big bill indeed.
So is this a really old subdivision or one of the newer ones?
It's fairly new. It was built in the late 90s. At least construction started then. It was kind of finished up in the early 2000s, and that's when they put these homes at the back of the valley, which are now being threatened by two hillsides that are being eroded over time and have the potential for landslide.
So what's the name of that neighborhood?
It's called Launani Valley, and the specific neighborhood is called Wood Creek Crossing.
So what's the situation? I mean, why are they facing this huge bill?
Well, the Community Association Board of Directors for the past couple years have been trying to mitigate these two hillsides. They've monitored them. They've watched them slowly erode. So now the Community Association is trying to take action to keep this from to keep any of the homes from getting damaged. Their board president tells me that if any of the homes were to be damaged, it could open them up to lawsuit, which could mean even heftier prices that people might have to pay.
Oh, well, that's not good. what's the situation? How many homes are in harm's way potentially?
Around 8 homes are being affected by the landslides. However, more than 800 homes have to pay for this because they're part of a community association. According to their bylaws, everyone has to pay in to help repair these hills.
So what was on the table? What were their options?
They originally had an option to finance this with a loan. A vote was sent out to all of the residents. Many of them did vote to finance it with a loan, which would have raised their monthly fees by about $30 to $40 a month, or about $280 a quarter, which a lot of residents told me would be more financially feasible for them. However, the board says that they didn't get enough votes, so now they're going to charge each resident about $4,000 to help pay for this $3.2 million project.
Right, and I imagine a lot of folks don't have $4,000 sitting around.
Yes, many of them tell me it's not, and that's the big issue here. It's a major financial burden for people. Residents have told me it's right around the holidays, so this isn't something they planned for. They now have to change their plans to make accommodations for it.
So I guess, though, everybody's now up in arms. They've got their attention. So what's the solution?
It's not quite clear what the solution is just yet. There's a couple options being thrown around right now. Residents have started a petition, and I believe they have just about enough signatures to force the board of directors to call a special meeting to further discuss funding options. The board of directors is also speaking with attorneys to try to pursue legal action against the companies who originally developed the land.
Do you know who developed it? Was it Castle and Cook or someone else?
That's also not quite clear. It's not Castle and Cook. One of the names being thrown around was Town Home Developments, and it's still not quite clear who they could go after. But what I can tell you is that this isn't just a problem in Launani Valley. Developers since the 40s, the 50s, in valleys like Palolo, in Manoa, they've built on these hillsides that have sometimes proven to be unstable. So this isn't just an isolated incident.
Right. And I know with all the heavy rains, I'm sure that's a really big concern for those homes that are right up against that area.
Yep. Always a big concern. I think in the late 80s, heavy rainfall caused a massive landslide in Manoa. And certainly with the last two storms that we've had on Oahu, residents told me that they have had their concerns with those as well.
Yeah, so very scary if you're in harm's way. I can see that. All right, thanks so much, Blaise. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was reporter Blaise Lovell with today's Reality Check. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org.
I know a lot of people think economics is boring, but I promise you, it's not. I'm Noelle King. I co-host Morning Edition, and I also cover economics. Money. Having it, not having it, shapes where we live, how much we work, and sometimes how we vote. Like a lot of people, you might be feeling this thing we're calling economic anxiety. You're hearing words like tariff and trade war and fiscal policy. It's our job to break it down and help you understand all this complicated stuff. And right now, you're also hearing donate and contribution and sustaining membership. You may be wondering how that last one works. When you give every month, you make sure all the reporting and analysis that you rely on keeps coming. Look, I know there's a lot out there that's confusing and difficult, but becoming a sustaining member is easy and it makes economic sense. Here's how to do it, and thanks.
The HPR website is open for your donation at any time, or let us help you set up your sustaining plan by calling during business hours.
This week on Says You,
even though I'm demonstrating it to you by holding it in front of my face,
on radio,
breaking ground with NPR mime on the radio.
He's actually making shadow plays here. Two elk at a watering hole.
It's fast, it's fun, it's some of the most colorful radio on the air, Says You.
This evening at 6:30.
Around this time last week, the Honolulu Museum of Art was planning to open a new King Kalakaua exhibit, but it was put off because of the threat of Hurricane Olivia. It was rescheduled this past Saturday, Kama'aina Day, and we were on hand as the museum opened its doors. Curator Hialoa Johnson says it was a joint effort by the Hawaii State Archives, Bishop Museum, the State Museum, and Iolani Palace to tell a story of an era in one place. Musician Palani Vaughn sets the stage.
In 1890, King Kalakaua left Honolulu for San Francisco, California, aboard the USS Charleston. It is said that his queen, Kapi'olani, composed this love song for him while he was away. Himala ohe aloha, no ka ipo rei manu. He manu ku uhoa.
What we've done is we've pulled together pieces that tell a story about the time period, King Kalakaua's reign, and the creative dynamism that existed under his leadership.
And so what will people be able to see when they come to this exhibit?
When they come here, they will see photographs that they've never seen before. They will see paintings that he commissioned for his 50th birthday. They will see featherwork that has traveled around the world. They will see royal orders that have been gifted to and from our ali'i.
And so tell us, what's so significant about this era?
It was a time period that, despite all obstacles and challenges, flourished. Artwork and creativity and the circulation of ideas were thriving in the Hawaiian kingdom. And under King Kalakaua and Queen Kapi'olani, people were encouraged to create and to share their thoughts and ideas. And that wasn't always the norm around the world at that time.
And they traveled extensively. I mean, it really was quite remarkable.
King Kalakaua embarked on a world tour in 1881, and then in 1887, Queen Kapi'olani and then Crown Princess Liliuokalani went to London via the United States. Interestingly, Queen Kapi'olani, you know, as she traveled to the United States, the newspapers would write about the gowns that she was wearing, and they would also describe her in many cases as the first queen to visit their city. So, you know, newspapers in Chicago talk about Queen Kapi'olani, the first queen from another country to visit. People would request that she wear certain things because they'd heard about her beautiful gowns. And, you know, they talk about her reception in Washington, D.C. with President Grover Cleveland. Of course, King Kalakaua, interestingly enough, you know, after starting this research, my friends and colleagues started to come across things and would forward these articles to me. And sure enough, just a couple of weeks ago, I was forwarded an article about King Kalakaua, and the title of the newspaper was Brilliant Beyond Precedent. And so, you know, it isn't just our time that reflects upon the Kalākaua era and sees a brilliant mind at work, but even during his lifetime, other countries were acknowledging his contribution.
Do you have a favorite piece? Mm. Since it's taken you a while to kind of go through the inventory of what's available and what you were able to curate.
I really love the photography in the exhibition, and I think I moved especially knowing how Kalākaua was leveraging it to position Hawaii within the international consciousness of the world. And if you ask me tomorrow, I'll say the featherwork. Okay. And if you ask me the day after, I'll say the Joseph Strong painting.
And so you have some actually very large paintings in there.
So those were commissioned by King Kalākaua, and they're created by an artist named Joseph D. Strong. He was actually the court photographer. He ended up painting these two murals. They're large-scale works. They're both Honolulu Harbor, but one is set in 1836. The other is set in 1886, the year of Kalākaua's birth, the year of his 50th jubilee. So they were painted in 1886, and what you see is a contrast between a quiet harbor, by comparison, to what is in 1886 depicting Hawaii, Honolulu Harbor, as the center of commerce within the Pacific. And so the artist and his approach, I mean, his brushstrokes, the paint application, everything is hustle bustle. And the subject matter is, of course, you know, an active shoreline, a harbor that is robust with many structures. And you can see Iolani Palace, you can see Aliiolani Hale, and numerous other structures that can still be identified.
I've seen some of the gowns of that period. They're very striking.
Oh, yeah, they're fabulous. So Queen Kapiolani is known for especially the peacock gown, right? So she goes to London to participate in the Queen's Jubilee, Queen Victoria's Jubilee. And she has a blue gown that was designed by a New York designer, B. Altman, but then also modified by a Hawaiian designer, Lono McGuire, who compiled these peacock feathers into beautiful panels that draped down the front, the back, marked the trimming of the train of the dress and also the bodice. And it was really a way of combining many different aesthetics, but also maintaining a relationship connection with the Hawaiian symbols, the feathers, and the, you know, the relationship to the ali'i. You know, King Kalākaua was not the first king to participate in the World Fair as a country on behalf of Hawaii, but he was the first to really leverage it and to maximize it. And so under his leadership, under his governance, Hawaii participates in more World Fairs than ever. And although we often think about, you know, art fairs as contemporary art experiences today, they were, in the past, they were platforms for countries to demonstrate competence, wealth, success, and, you know, Hawaii used that as a way of positioning itself on the international stage. And what I love is that it was a combination of all things. So when you come in to the exhibition, you will see a painting by Joseph Nawahi. It is thought that one of the only very few of his works traveled around the world, the one that we have on view, might be one of them. And in combination with a painting by Nawahi is, you know, we know that the Ipu Aina also traveled. We know that Ahu'ula also traveled. And so it wasn't this either or, but rather this inclusion of many different types of materials and lots of different kinds of artworks as a way to display Hawaii's incredible cosmopolitanism, diversity, and success as a country, as an independent country. And so oftentimes what were included in these art fairs were also maps, books, and it was a way for Hawaii to be able to demonstrate a competent administrative leadership and then also, you know, bilingual capabilities, right? We were producing literature in multiple languages. And so all of that was just a platform to show Hawaii's intellectual and creative capacity. You know, one of the greatest aspects to this exhibition is really collaborating across institutions, and thankfully, they all saw the value in coming together and contributing what each organization could offer in terms of their collections, in terms of their staff time. And everybody prioritized it and saw the value in what the community could appreciate in having an exhibition like this. So the featherwork came from the Honolulu Museum of Art and also from Bishop. And those featherwork pieces, like Queen Kapiolani's riding cape, is not to be missed. The photography also came from Bishop Museum Archives. Incredible. Most of those photographs have never been, the originals have never been displayed before, which is great. Iolani Palace, so if you look at the photographs of Queen Liliuokalani and Queen Kapiolani as they were traveling, you'll notice in those photographs they're adorned in particular accessories, and Iolani Palace lent the beautiful diamond-encrusted butterfly pin that belonged to the then princess, Crown Princess Liliuokalani, Queen Kapiolani's necklace. The organizations loaned royal orders. I mean, that was a huge undertaking. And mission houses, they lent the Navajo painting. And Hawaii State Archives lent those two large murals by Joseph Strong that we were talking about. They also lent an incredible uniform that was worn by Mortimer Gibson. I would just like to say thank you to all of the organizations who did come together to be able to execute an exhibition like this, and that, you know, we did it sincerely for the community, who we know are very passionate about our ali'i, and to tell a story that has been underheard.
That was Honolulu Museum of Art curator Healoha Johnson talking about the King Kalakaua exhibit, which opened this weekend and runs through January 27th.
Aloha, I'm Corey Rosen-Lee from the Hawaii State Teachers Association. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Earlier in the program, we asked for the names of two sister seamstresses credited for creating the first palaka board shorts. Jane Oda and Catherine Kawaguchi of the Miura family adopted their grandfather's design of palaka shirts for plantation workers and designed a new type of shorts that surfers could wear. Palaka is the is Hawaii's version of plaid. It's even been referred to as Hawaii's denim, since the woven dark blue and white fabrics replicated its toughness. Today, if you want to buy a pair of your own original Miura palaka surf shorts, the only place to find them is at a secondhand shop or maybe in a family member's closet. That's because the Miura store closed down the production line in 2005, and no one in our islands continues to make palaka shorts. You can, however, purchase palaka replicas online from outdoor retailers. Now, no one got that today, so we stumped you on this. But that's today's quiz, and if you have an idea for one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Taylor Camp. It's the name of Kauai's hippie community in the 1960s. A documentary about it has now been updated and renamed. It debuted on the Garden Isle and now heads to the Big Island. We talked to the filmmaker about the edge of paradise, John Werheim.
There are Taylor campers in Honolulu, of course, Kauai, Big Island, Maui. Yeah, they're all over Kauai and all over the world, we're discovering. We're really shaking them out of the bushes with the film and the book and all the publicity we're getting. It's pretty amazing.
So tell us now, you folks have recut this, remastered it. What got you going on this?
Well, we thought we finished the film in 2011, and we did it in standard def. So we released it in standard def 2011, and it got rave reviews. I don't know if you saw that at the Hawaii Theater then, but we filled the Hawaii Theater up twice, and we had a line around the block. I think it wrapped more than around the block. So it did really well, but it was in standard def, and that really limited our market. And the cost of converting to high def back then was prohibitive, so we just thought, okay, we'll kind of fall back on DVD sales. Book sales were good, and then we're done. But the film really wouldn't let us go, you know, even though we wanted to let it go. And We've had so much publicity, and you know, we don't have a publicist and we don't do PR, but you know, since then we've had just an avalanche of unsolicited media attention. I don't know if you've seen the Huffington Post article, you know, that was 2 million plus views and shares. It's been in Smithsonian, London Daily Mail, Slate, BuzzFeed, et cetera, et cetera. And the thing that really kind of shook some people out of the bushes for us is that we've had print articles, as well as all the blogs, you know, across the U.S., but in England, France, Germany, Spain, Brazil, Japan, and, you know, it's all translated into these languages. And, you know, we've now got over 20 million magazine, blog, and social media views, and the film's been translated into German. We've got a contract on Spiegel TV for 3 years. So as a result of all this new material came to us. People said, oh, you know, and we knew that we hadn't told the whole story. You know, but we just gave up. You know, we told the story that we had because we couldn't. We decided very early that we were not going to use a narrator and that the story would be told by the Taylor campers, by their neighbors, by the people of Kauai. And we just couldn't find some of these people who were really integral to the story. You know, like the Vietnam flight surgeon vet who was became the doctor at Taylor Camp and delivered the first baby. You know, the guy who started the free store and started the restaurant and got busted selling hashish to a federal narcotics officer and then ran off with his 3-year-old daughter to start a cocaine smuggling big business in South America. I mean, they're just crazy stuff.
And well, I imagine
it just came out of the woodwork. Plus, surf footage. People started sending us this incredible surf footage and old photographs, and we just decided, okay, it's not letting us go.
Well, I know that there is another film that I thought was remarkable. It was called 7 Up, and they went and they documented kids at age 7, got them, you know, when they were older, 21, 28.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I can see that you could use that same concept going back to the original residents of Taylor Camp. Like, whatever happened to Elizabeth Taylor's brother?
He moved to, he got sort of fed up with the whole situation, and shortly after Taylor Camp was closed by the state, I don't want to tell the whole story on that because it's the great conclusion of the film. Anyway, Howard, the government put him through a lot, and he just left Kauai after that and moved to Taos, New Mexico, where he still lives.
I can imagine, though, some folks maybe, you know, don't want to be found.
That's Howard Taylor. He doesn't want to be found. You know, he's a very private, you know, maybe the exact opposite of his sister. Very great guy, sort of a libertarian, you know, a lot of compassion. That's why he originally bailed these people out of the county jail. And a wonderful artist, just a great person. And, you know, that was my introduction to Taylor Camp when I first moved to Kauai in 1970, I lived with Howard and his family. He had a little guest house, A-frame, in his backyard, and suddenly there are these people coming over wanting to borrow tools, and then who are these long hair hippie types and these surfer guys? And actually, once in a while, some of them, you know, Howard had over for dinner, and so that was my introduction to Taylor Camp. Howard Taylor and his family.
I think, you know, it's just so intriguing just to find out what these people are doing now. I mean, like you said, some live on Kauai, some are on the neighbor islands, some are here on Oahu.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Well, that is what the film is about. It's a then and now film, and we go back to then, you know, the late 60s, early 70s on Kauai, and what happened, what life was like. And we really used Taylor Camp sort of as a vehicle to tell the story of Kauai. and the state of Hawaii, but more specifically Kauai, during a time of incredible transition, just phenomenal transition. And it was a transition, and it was that moment, that transition that allowed Taylor Camp to happen. Now, there's a bigger story here. You know, it's the whole, you know, crazy 60s, 70s, hippie rebellion movement that was not just in America, but, I mean, it was worldwide. It happened everywhere. It even happened in China. You know, I mean, the Red Guards were basically crazy hippies. You know, it would be, the Red Guards were like if Nixon armed the Black Panthers and the Weather Underground, because that's exactly what Mao did, and said, okay, destroy your colleges and shoot your professors. And it could have gotten really ugly in America, except the government wouldn't let it get ugly. And so what was all our alternative? Peace and love, or get your head broke.
Well, when I saw the trailer, just love the music. That's my music.
Yeah, we worked on the music a lot, and it took a tremendous amount of negotiation to get the music, to get it licensed.
I bet.
It was tough. It was very expensive, but we didn't want to scrimp on the music. We thought it was we didn't want to use anything that was digitally produced. You know, we wanted that sound that, you know, it's just different. You know, the music that was done back in that era, it sounds different, and it is different, and we wanted the music to transport people emotionally.
It does.
Back to that time and thinking, oh, I was doing that, and I was there, and this is what I was feeling, and I think it works.
Talk about the change in title, because you went from Taylor Camp to The Edge of Paradise.
Well, I think the reason why things are really going well for us is we've got an executive producer. You know, I'm the writer and producer, my friend and colleague Bob Stone from Maui. So here I am on Kauai, right? I mean, as far as filmmakers, it's the end of the earth. And my partner Bob Stone, he's on Maui, and we don't know anything. We don't know anybody. You know, but we made this film that's got all this attention. So we realized we needed help, and we got an executive producer, you know, out of L.A., Hollywood, who really gave us a lot of guidance to the edit. But he told us, you know, Taylor Camp is a historic event, just kind of well-known, especially among older people, not just on Kauai, but in Hawaii. But he said nobody knows it. Nobody knows what it is in the rest of the world. So, and then we've got this theme. You know, it's not paradise; it's the edge of paradise, because you never get, you know. And that's also the opening quote from Marcel Proust that we use in the film, and that is, the only true paradise is a paradise lost. And this is sort of the after the fall, being driven from the garden theme of the film, and so that's why, you know, it went from Taylor Camp to the Edge of Paradise, and it's got some different meanings on different levels. But part of it is, you know, of course, utopia, paradise. You never quite get there. But another thing is, you know, this Taylor Camp was right on the edge of the Nepali coast in the Kalalau Trail, and for a lot of people, that's the edge of paradise, and so that's. That element is there too. But this whole thing, you know, this paradise theme, and a lot of people talk about that. I mean, that word is used a lot in the interviews, not just by the Taylor Campers, but even by local people. And it would really be easy to spin this film into surfer hippie propaganda. You know, I mean, we could have edited that way, but especially with the new edit and the new interviews we got, we went into a much deeper, darker side of Taylor Camp, which we thought was very important. Now, we tried to be balanced in the first film, but we didn't quite have all the material we needed. And, you know, most of the Taylor Camp, you know, I guess we call them alumni, you know, the former residents, they refer to their time at Taylor Camp as the best days of our lives. I mean, that we hear that over and over again. But, you know, this is the earth, you know, human beings. Just like any other community, Taylor Camp had had the good and the bad. And it represents, a lot of what happens in Hawaii. A lot of people move to Hawaii running away from something. And that's a theme throughout this Taylor Camp film. That something is usually themselves. And it was no different at Taylor Camp. You know, many people went there expecting the place to heal them. You know, not just physically, but psychologically. And it's understandable, right? Clothing optional, pot friendly, tree houses on the beach, and one of the most beautiful beaches in the world, gateway to the Nepali coast, Kalalau, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, I'm going to go there and be happy. Of course not, you know, especially if you're running away from yourselves. So some people just thought that they'd hop off, get off the plane or move over from Honolulu or the south side, wherever they're coming from. And they were kind of like expecting a faith healing, you know, without really doing the kind of work that requires, that we all require spiritually. So, you know, it's like thinking you can get in shape without exercising. You just show up and everything's going to be fine.
Right.
You know?
Well, I can't wait to see it when it comes to Honolulu. You plan to screen it anywhere else on the mainland?
Oh yeah, we've screened at the Sedona Film Festival, standing room only. Just a great crowd. I think the next festival is Byron Beach, and so it's being screened from Australia to Tel Aviv. You know, it's happening.
That was John Wareheim, the force behind the film. After four sold-out screenings on Kauai, The Edge of Paradise travels to the Hilo Palace this week for Friday through Tuesday screenings. And as you heard, that film is described as the story of a pot-friendly, clothing-optional treehouse community at the end of the road on Kauai. That is it for today. Up tomorrow, Go for Broke winds up this week's look at locally produced films. Tell us what's on your mind. Call or talk back line. Leave us your comment. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.